Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Arzuma Sini. I'm the Senior Art Librarian at Mid-Manhattan Library, and it's a great pleasure introducing tonight's program with Gretchen Berg, Gerard Malenga, Taylor Mead, Stephen Watson, and John Wilcock. We're here to celebrate the publication of the autobiography and sixth life of Andy Warhol with a discussion and book signing. The book is a collection of interviews with Warhol's closest associates, friends, and superstars as it depicts the infamous factory scene of the 60s and provides an intimate look into the career, personality, and private life of Andy Warhol. The discussion will be moderated by Dr. Stephen Watson, a cultural historian and writer who's interested in the group dynamics of the 20th century American avant-garde. His most recent book, titled Factory Maid, Warhol and the 1960s, was published in 2003. Gretchen Berg is a photojournalist who worked in the underground press during the 1960s. Her groundbreaking interview, Andy Warhol, My True Story, is recognized as one of the most revealing interviews with Andy Warhol. Gerard Malenga is a poet, photographer, and filmmaker, and was Andy Warhol's assistant. He was influential in bringing many people to the factory scene through his connections to the world of fashion and poetry. Taylor Mead is an actor and poet who has been active in New York arts community since the 1960s and was part of the 50s beat scene in San Francisco. He appeared in several Andy Warhol films, including Couch and Lonesome Cowboys. It's not often that this many of the factory people show up in one place at the same time since the factory days. So I'd like to thank our guests for appearing on this program, marking the seventh event in the new series, An Art Book, celebrating the essential importance and beauty of art publications with presentations and discussions by world-renowned artists, critics, curators, designers, historians, and writers. Copies of the autobiography and sixth life of Andy Warhol are available for purchase and signing at the end of tonight's program. There will be a Q&A right after the discussion, and we also have a surprise guest. I will let Stephen Watson introduce our surprise guest. I would like to thank everyone for attending this program, which is absolutely overcrowded, and I apologize to those of you who do not have a seat. And I think it's time that we begin the program. I'd like to turn the floor to Christopher Torella, who single-handedly resurrected the book.
Thank you. I guess I should start off the evening with saying that I never met Andy Warhol, and I never had sex with him either. The story of the book, I felt like this is a presentation about a book, and I felt like I should take you guys through the short story, try to make it as concise as possible so we can get to some of the juicy details of Andy Warhol. But I wanted to sort of tell you the story of how this book came about. This is the original book that John published in 1971. I found it at a street fair in 1991 in New York City. Before the internet, there was a time, and before everyone had cell phones. And I thought it was a really interesting book. It's a collection of interviews with, you know, people who worked with Warhol. And I was always interested in art and Warhol. And I thought this was a fantastic book. And John had done a wonderful job doing these interviews back in the late 1960s, 1970. The thing about the book that was very unusual was this was the only information contained within the book whatsoever. It was by some guy named John Wilcock, who I never heard of. There were photos by Shunk Kender, whoever they were, and another guy named Hank, who designed it, and I never found him. Other than that, there were no page numbers, there was no descriptions, there were no captions. That was it. And it was, but it was fascinating. And as I started to get into the interviews, I mean, it had a great title. I mean, if any book had a great title, this was it. And I'm like, this is just an interesting book. It sat on my shelf for about 6 or 7 years. And I'm like, you know, I should republish this book. So I started doing some research. Around this time, I found an article in the New York Times from 1973 about John. It was this is only part of the article. It was 4,500 words. It was a huge, long article. And hopefully after tonight, no one can say this, that nobody knows him, and he'll actually be known for the things that he had done at the time. I read this article with fascination, and I sought out to find John somewhere. Of course, this was still as the internet was developing, and I couldn't find him. But to give you a sense of what the book looks like, the book started with this interesting guy holding a Pepsi can alongside an interview. And most of the interviews all started with, where did you first meet Andy? How did you come to know him? It was sort of like meeting someone at a party. It was a friend of yours. And you say, how do you know him? And it's just a way to get into the interview. And John had a really great manner in these interviews with sort of introducing these characters who I didn't know who half of them were, but the interviews were fantastic, and you kind of figured it out as you read the book. It had a really interesting crop of characters, everyone from Lou Reed, there's Gerard, Bridget, Taylor. There was a couple of articles in the book, one about a road trip that they took out in a bus that Nico drove out to Michigan to play at Ann Arbor. Gretchen, Marisol, Sam Green, all these people were influential in one form or another, and I won't get into each of their stories because I could talk for the next 2 hours, but they were all really interesting characters, and the interviews were fantastic. I don't know why John chose to illustrate his article or his interview with a picture of Andy, but that's the way it was in the original book. These are some other selected pages from the book. So, it was interesting. It was three columns, two columns. There was no indication as to who was speaking. You got lost within the interviews, and it just didn't make sense. And there was a lot of artwork, and the photographs were wonderful. And so this is the last page of the book, and this is the back cover. So my quest began to find John. So I called the Andy Warhol Museum. They had never heard of him. And about a year later, I called back, and they said, oh, well, he just stopped by. We have his phone number. There's a lot of John Wilcox in the phone book. And again, this is around the time that the internet's starting to get going and things are starting to be listed. And I looked through the phone book. That's what I did. And people are listed. People don't use the phone book, but people are listed. And so that was the way that I found who Harry Shunk was. At this time, I had found John. I had spoken to him. He loved the idea of republishing the book. And he said, well, you got to find Harry Shunk because the book is not a book without these wonderful photos. I found Shunk by looking him up in the phone book, and I called him, and this is a picture of Harry that I took at the Chelsea Hotel in the lobby. We met one night when he gave me a box of photos, and after I met him, he really loved the idea of republishing the book, and he gave me a box of photos and said, great, I loved working on the book originally, and he just handed me 108 photographs one afternoon at the Chelsea Hotel. I snapped this picture of him, which is one of the few pictures of him. He was actually part of a photography team that worked throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s with another photographer, Janos Kender. I never met Kender. He had disappeared by this time, and Harry was on his own. But Harry had been Christo's photographer in the late 60s and early 70s. He had taken an iconic photograph of Yves Klein from 1960. He's taken photos of every major artist of the 20th century. His archive was recently acquired by the Roy Lichtenstein Foundation. I think close to 100,000 negative, 60,000 photographs, and they're busy archiving them now. There's wonderful, wonderful photographs within the archive. So I found Harry, I had found John, and the quest was on to publish the book. And these are some of the photos that Harry gave me of the people from the book. A lot of them were unpublished, had never been seen before. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of photos in the archive that I haven't even seen. But Harry was a really interesting guy, and he passed away in 2006. I went down to his apartment about a week after he died, and they said they found him in his apartment. His archive got turned over to the city because he left no heirs. So I took all the wonderful photos, and this is a photo that Gretchen actually took, and I show it because it's in the same location, 35 years previous to the photo that I took of Harry. This is Valerie Solanas. She looks a little like Lily Taylor here, but this was at the Chelsea Hotel, and Gretchen took this photo, I think, in 1967. It's unpublished. It's in the book, actually. The other thing that showed up at the time was the collection of interviews. John had fortuitously donated them for some reason to Northwestern University. And so what did I do? I took a plane out to Chicago and went to Evanston, Illinois, and I sat down for 4 days and I listened to all the tapes of the interviews and I transcribed them all again and corrected all the errors. Actually, my sister typed up the entire book for me. And then I took the two and merged them together and corrected everything. Came back with that. This is at Northwestern. Actually, it was more, it's more like this one. That was the library. I studied there and re-recorded and listened to all these tapes as these interviews of these wonderful people came alive. The book got redesigned, and this is what the book became. Harry had given me this wonderful picture of Gerard and Andy in a hotel room bed in 1965 in Paris when they went there for an exhibition. And when I saw the picture, I'm like, this has got to be the cover of the book. And you'll notice if you look at the book, and Gerard's picture is on the back. It folds over. I heard wonderful stories about what a great trip this was. The other thing I found is that Gretchen had a photo of Andy and John together at a party at Stan Vanderbeek's house in 1966, I believe, in Connecticut. And it seemed that Andy always went to sit next to John at these types of get-togethers and gatherings, and finding this photo was just wonderful. So this is how the book opens, with a wonderful spread from the photo shoot in Paris. And then there are two of Gretchen's photos. I supplemented the factory portraits with about a dozen of Gretchen's photos that appear throughout the book. And then the book opens with an introduction by John with the photos that Gretchen had taken of him. And then just to get a sense of how I designed the book or how it was conceived was, it was thought, I wanted to replicate John's book and have a portrait of each person alongside their name, and also at this time, a mini bio, so you knew who actually these people were, and then some delineation between who's speaking and who's being interviewed, and so you could actually follow along. And this is actually a book that's meant to be read, and so I felt like I could improve on it and make it read. So I'm just going to take you through some of the pages of the book so you get a sense of the design. It's got these wonderful pull quotes that I pulled. There's one that's very prophetic that Gretchen made about Andy that's very true. And so you get a sense of some of the characters in the book and what some of the pages are like. I picked the artwork that I liked of Andy. I sat at the Artist Resource Center, which is a clearinghouse for copyrights. And since I was such a Warhol fan, it was, you know, every picture that Warhol's ever done, I picked only the artwork before 1971 and used that to illuminate what was in the book. And this gives you a sense of the very colorful appeal of the book, how I modernized it to give it a look that is contemporary and readable. This is an unpublished photo of Naomi Levine. We didn't have a still of her, but the Andy Warhol Museum pulled one from their archives for me of her. She's one of Andy's first superstars. You get a sense of the layout. It's very clean and readable and supplemented with the artwork and Gretchen and mostly Harry's photos of some of the people within the book. It's a famous Taylor Mead's Ass, which was a film that Taylor might remember. I don't know that it still looks like that. the other thing, John's book was in no order whatsoever, so I arbitrarily put it in alphabetical order. So I just kind of took you through some of this. This was Warhol's first dealer, and I didn't have a photo of her, but Les Levine, the artist, had a photo he had done from the early 70s that he provided for the book. And then one other thing is that, like most Warhol things, I felt like, well, you have to do multiples and you have to do collectibles. So I've produced a couple of things alongside the book that I've done up. Actually, this is the actual book. It's a limited edition box set. There's only going to be 100 of these. It comes in a nice clamshell case, and one of Gretchen's original photos will appear inside. It will be signed and numbered. Taking pre-orders now. That's my sales plug. So it's that's the. And one other thing that I should mention is that we did a limited edition bookmark for the book. It's a banana fitting in with the Warhol aesthetic. Anyone who buys the book tonight gets a free bookmark. So it's my sales pitch. And that was the story. I'll turn it over to Stephen and the panel. Great.
It's amazing to look out at this crowd, so literally wall to wall. First of all, I want to tell you about our mystery guest, Bibi Hansen. And Bibi was in several of the Warhol films when she was about 14. She came into the Warhol factory, Silver Factory, in late 64, and she was there during 64 and 65. So we'll get a sense from Bibi what it looked like from an adolescence point of view. I want to very briefly lay out a chronology so that we're going to jump around a lot on the panel. We assume today that Warhol was always famous. Not so. This group essentially is part of the Silver Factory. Girard came into the scene in June 1963, had silk screening experience, so Andy hired him thanks to the introduction from Charles Henry Ford. Charles and Girard worked continuously with Andy until 1967. Andy met Taylor in August of 63. And very shortly after that, Girard and Taylor and Wynn Chamberlain went across the country for the first big Warhol show at the Ferris Gallery. It was also when Andy made his first real semi-story film, Tarzan and Jane Regained, sort of. And that starred Taylor Mead. It's fair to say that at that time, Taylor was as much a star as Andy Warhol, because he was the first underground star of Ron Rice's film, The Flower Thief. 64 is both a time of making art and it's the beginning of making movies and especially the screen tests. 65, it's fair to say the movies are much more important. This is sort of the real beginning of the superstar era. And it's the Edie Sedgwick era and so forth. 66, you might think of as the Velvet Underground years, when that became one of the main focuses of the factory. That's when Gretchen came into the picture. And Girard danced with the Velvets, and 67 they continued making films. 68 they moved from the Silver Factory down to Union Square, and of course in June 68 Valerie Solanas shot Andy. So we'll be jumping back and forth over those times. Now, this is as much, in my mind, a tribute to John Wilcock. I know you didn't come here because of John Wilcock. But I want to say, you know, I'm not saying that just to be promotional. It's out of respect and real affection. But the one who really wants to talk about John is Girard. So I'm going to just turn it over to Girard to read a testimonial.
This I got to hear.
John Wilcock, a testimonial. Paris, on $10 a day. London, on $10 a day. Rome, on $10 a day. Remember those days? The days of cheap steamship travel across the Atlantic and then looking for a place to stay and a good meal? John Wilcock does. He wrote books with those titles on how to stretch the almighty dollar to get more bang for your buck while summering across Europe. John certainly had the wanderlust and temperament in those days and turned it into a byproduct that any holiday traveler, backpacker, or college student could easily relate, finding one's way to those hideaway, inexpensive pension and trattoria. He had a built-in audience. He wrote the everyman's Carl Baedeker. John was always the keen observer without drawing attention to himself. He loved to report, always inquisitive, always the tiny pencil clinging to his ear and a pocket-sized notepad ever ready. He loved the challenge. With facts in hand, he loved to work things out on the page. No frills, no highfalutin Paris Review hyperbole. He was at the right place at the right time with the right ideas, co-founding the Village Voice and authoring his own weekly column, The Village Square, right from his studio flat, one block from the office. When he got tired of that, he went on to write for the East Village Other and later started Other Scenes, a truly tabloid's tabloid covering everything that was underground worth knowing about, and for which I guest edited an entire issue on underground cinema, eroticism, and visual poetry, as it was called. And finally, his crowning achievement, Interview, in those days with a slash down the middle, co-founded by Warhol and yours truly, but John was really the brains and guiding spirit. He even had his own art director slash layout man and a distribution network to boot. John taught me how to look at photos in the context of text, body copy, what have you. A perfect match, as my photography was just getting off the ground and some of my earliest pictures found their way in Interview's pages. And now it's 41 years after, to be exact. John is still doing the thing he loves best, writing about those sights and sounds and the people he's met along the way. Thank you, John.
Yeah. Very kind of you. Thank you. Okay.
Well, I think we've had entirely too much appreciation, so it's time to turn to Taylor and me.
Well, I'll piggyback on this book because I have a book with an agent. In fact, I finished it while Andy was alive. And he said, Uncle Taylor, you can say whatever you want to about me. It's called Son of Andy Warhol, Sequel to Son of Frankenstein. someone wrote something about I shot Andy Warhol and in Downtown Magazine or something. So I wrote an article, I would have shot Andy Warhol. But I miss him. Oh, I miss shooting him. I forget him. I miss But we had several shootings before at the factory on 47th Street. And I want to say that Tarzan and Jane, which we made in 63, one of the few times Andy appeared on screen in a movie, and He pointed to a coconut tree, and I'm Tarzan and all that little thing. And he wants me to climb a tree to get a coconut. But I had a stand-in named Dennis Hopper. And I took the script from Andy and tore it up and gave Dennis a couple of bucks to go up a tree again. I think it's the first time Dennis really relaxed in a movie. I think it helped him tremendously. Anyway.
That was on the grounds of the Beverly Hills Hotel by the swimming pool.
Yeah.
Part of it was, yeah. We got so bored at the Beverly Hills Hotel, we went to a motel on Santa Monica Beach. So. But we had, we arrived and Dennis Hopper gave us a great party with Fonda and all kinds of the children of the big stars. Wonderful party, and I insisted we stay at the Beverly Hills Hotel. I was tired of the cheap motels Andy kept taking us to. And so Dennis's wife was Brooke Hayward, and her father Leland Hayward, a big Broadway producer. And it was a World Series was going on, and you couldn't get a room. But Brooke called her father in New York, and he gave us his suite at the Beverly Hills. And we shot a lot of some great stuff in a tub with Naomi Levine. She was my Jane. She followed us out there, and I said, she cannot be, she's so pushy, we don't want her in this movie. We said, we'll give her a few minutes, and it turned out she was fantastic as Jane, with a great bosom and everything.
Well, Tarzan and Jane is really one of the most entertaining of the Warhol films, I think, and too rarely seen. Another one that is very rarely seen is Prison, which starred Bibi Hansen and Edie Sedgwick. And Bibi, I would like you to just give some sense what the perspective coming into the factory as a 14-year-old, how did you get there and what did it seem like?
Okay, well, the story is pretty well known, but for present company, I had was doing the galleries with my father, Al Hansen, who was an artist, and every Saturday people would go up Madison Avenue, down first we'd go east on 57th Street and then come up Madison Avenue and end up at Castelli Gallery and then at Stark's, which was a chain of like a restaurant bar chain. And I walked in with my dad. And the day before, I had actually been in jail in a youth jail for about 4 or 5 months, the notorious Spofford Street in the South Bronx, which has recently closed, thank goodness. And I had gone to court on the Friday, and surprise, surprise, they'd let me go. I had no idea I was going to get out, and my father got custody of me. So the next day, here we are doing the galleries, and ended up at Stark's, and in one corner was Gerard and Andy and Chuck and a bunch of other artists, and my dad and I went and joined them, and somebody bought us a meal, because we very rarely had the price of a restaurant meal on us. Somebody bought us a burger, and my dad a beer, and me a big chocolate milkshake. And sort of sat around being bored while they were all talking grown-up art talk, and suddenly Andy peered across the table at me and he said, "And you, what do you do?" And my father piped up, "I just sprung her from jail." And I think in one breath, both Chuck and Andy said at once, "Oh, tell us about that." And immediately I told them some war stories, two or three war stories, and they were quite delighted. And Andy said, "Oh, would you come to the factory and make a movie with me about jail?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, love to. When?" And Monday. And I said, "Sure." And my father said, "No, she can't come on Monday. She has to go to school. If she doesn't go to school, they're going to throw her back in jail again." So that was kind of delightful, too. "Oh, she has to go to school, of course.
Of course."
But it was decided that I would come after school. And I came after school on that Monday. And we did not make Prison for several weeks or a couple of months after that. But we did make a screen test, I think my first screen test. And that's how I came to the factory. Although, you know, as I related, I had been to jail. I was a street kid. I was in a lot of trouble. So there wasn't really anything going on up there that I hadn't seen. And it was generally a lot calmer than most of the places I had been.
Uh-huh. And, you know, there's someone in the audience formerly known as Little Joey, now known as Joseph Freeman. Who is a kind of office boy, and he's remarked on how Andy was so open to very young people.
Absolutely.
And I think that's not a story that's told well enough.
Well, we hear a lot about Andy's, Andy being very cynical, and there are those, that there is that side, especially later, I believe, but Stephen Schur was 16 years old and a photographer at the factory. David Dalton and his sister, Sarah. Sarah was the editor on, was it Sleep?
Yep.
The editor on Sleep, and she was 16 at the time, I believe. And Andy, she famously asked Andy after he showed her how to do a simple splice, a little splice machine, if he had any instructions for her. And he said, well, just if you see anything interesting, cut it out. And I was 14 and 15 when I was there, so we were very young people, and always had the feeling of being very included, and not. There's usually a point when you're a very young scenester where they're like, "Dump the kid, okay? We're going out now. Dump the kid." And I never really experienced that. So many times I was included. So many times I was brought along and seen after in a fashion that wasn't present anywhere else in my life. But Gerard was incredibly helpful and kind, and as was Andy and Chuck.
So, John, I'm going to jump to you now. We all want to know some dish on the sex life of Andy Warhol.
Ah, yes. Mm.
And we know you had sex with Andy.
Hardly.
The thing you told me about Charles Henry Ford and the receiver,
that is
a very useful thing.
Well, I think the first thing to say, actually, is that despite the title, maybe you've guessed by now, it's not an autobiography and there's no sex in it. and about the only time it ever came up was during the interview with Charles Henry Ford, and I tried to press him to, because he'd known Andy a long time, and I tried to press him on the subject, and he said, "Andy's a receiver. He's a receiver." Now, I don't interpret that sexually, because what Andy really did was he received information like nobody I ever met. I mean, to be around the factory, you had to pay some dues. He was very catalytic, pushing people all the time to do something. I mean, even if you're sitting or you're supposed to be an actor or a superstar, the camera is grinding away at whatever it is, $100 a minute, and you don't have any script, you're pretty much obliged to produce. And a lot of people found access by producing information for Andy. I was a columnist at The Voice, and then I had my own paper, and I covered the art scene a lot. So I always had lots and lots of things to tell him. And Andy's reaction was usually, "Really? Really? Really?" You know? And you learn very quickly not to ask questions, to try and figure out what was going on. And the book was never intended to be a book. The book came out because I hung around there. I found it absolutely fascinating. I was a columnist for the Village Voice, and that gave me an access to a lot of things. There was barely a day went by when there wasn't something fascinating to do. And I just madly fell in love with my life at the factory and watching everything going on. And in the early days, when they were on 47th Street across the YMCA, they used to sometimes have the downstairs door locked. And this was the days before cell phones, and you had to call up, really, find a phone and call up and say, "Hey, I'm downstairs, will you let me in?" Well, I was always terrified that they wouldn't let me in. So what I did was I used to take an umbrella and pull down the fire escape. You know those New York fire escapes that come down? Mm-hmm. Pull down the fire escape, climb up and go in through the window. And I did that several times. So I got sort of familiar with the scene, but everything was so baffling. You could never figure out what was happening. I mean, one day he brought up a horse in the freight elevator. They were going to make a Western, and he had all these young, charming boys leaping on and off it, some with black hats and leaping on and off the horse. But the horse was stationed in front of the freight elevator.
And every time somebody came up in the elevator, they walked through the movie. And every time the phone rang, somebody had to walk into the movie and answer the phone on the wall. And that was the kind of thing that were just absolutely endless discussions around. Did he intend this? Was it planned? Was he just making the best of it and so on? And these discussions became so constant. I mean, they just, all the time, we just discussed things constantly. And eventually I just figured I just had to audio tape these things, these conversations. I don't think of them as interviews. I think of them as conversations with people who had become my friends, basically, because we were all equally mystified. One of the things that happens when you do something like this, and when Chris discovered this book and spent 10 years getting it out, and finally the publicity is breaking, and papers mention it and talk about this library event and the book signing and so on, and you then immediately start to suffer from media warp, you know? I mean, now I'm Andy's best friend and his bosom buddy who spent every moment with him and gave him advice and all the rest of it. Well, it's not really true. I mean, I wrote a piece on... Chris was very shrewd in the publicity in which he recounted a true story in which he said that I had been up at the factory for a few months, maybe 6 months or so, and Gerard came up to me one day and said, "We were wondering when you were going to be writing something about us." And that made me very paranoid. I thought, my God, they're going to like turn me out and not allow me to join in the fun and games anymore. And so I went down to The Voice and I bashed out this early piece on Andy being a movie maker. That was in 1965, and the book came out in 1971. So I actually did spend 6 or 7 years around the scene, and I was at the factory initially, maybe 3 or 4 times a week. And when I was interviewing Sam Green, he said something at one point, so I said to him, "Do you regard yourself, so you regard yourself a friend of Andy's, do you?" And he says, "Does anybody?" Because it was possible to live around him and see Andy every day and talk to him every day and still not feel you were really a friend. Friend was not a concept that, you know, that Andy applied, really, or it didn't seem to apply. So I started taking these notes, and a big event loomed, and that was the Whitney retrospective, 71, I believe. I started to put all this stuff together and realized we had a book. So Paul Morrissey gave me the title, The Autobiography of Sex Life of Andy Warhol, and we rushed out the book, and it was the way it was. It was just a bunch of conversations. I didn't explain the people. I didn't say who they were. I didn't give an index. I didn't give an introduction. I didn't even put them in alphabetical order, which is what Chris has done. But we brought this book out, and it disappeared just like lightning. It was $5 a copy. It sold out. I never made a cent out of it because of the Hollywood accounting of the people that printed it, who claimed it never made the money to pay for it. And it lay around until Chris found it, basically. The last thing I want to say about that particular aspect of the friendship thing is that Ronnie Tavell, who was a script writer, is quoted in Steve. By the way, Stephen's book is absolutely the end business. Anything to do with Warhol. He knows more about Warhol and the factory than any 10 people put together. Even people who spent every day with Andy, and for all I know, spent every day in bed with Andy. But Stephen never even was there, and yet he's done the definitive history of the period. Anyway, one of the things in his book, he quotes Ronnie Tavell, and Ronnie said, "You know, all the years I spent about Andy, I don't think we had more than 5 minutes of conversation." Back to you.
Okay. Well, I want to go to Gretchen now, because we, you know, talking about interviewing and so forth, one of the treats we have tonight is a chance to hear a little bit of the interview that Gretchen did with Andy in 1966. Now, Andy was famous for real put-on interviews, and I think he opened up much more when he didn't feel he was really on serious media. So we're going to hear a little bit, but Gretchen, I'd like you to set it up. Let us know a little bit what was your experience with seeing him and about his openness to you.
All right. I would like to start out. Can you hear me? I have a very low voice. I'd like to start out with the name of someone I was friends with at the time named Sheldon Renan. He's a writer and director, and he was a freelance writer at the time who wrote a book called Introduction to the American Underground Cinema, which is out of print now, but which I recommend to everyone. And he called up Andy and spoke to him. Then he called me up and said, you really should go over and speak to him. He's very nice and very easy to talk to. So I had been going to screenings of Andy's films. I had seen several of them. And they seemed to me not to be films at all in the usual sense of the word. That is, they use the medium of cinema, but they seemed to be more meditations and to belong to something like religious art rather than film. So I called him up. I had been published a little bit. I was published in Film Culture, which was an avant-garde magazine. And I had done interviews with Ouija, the photographer, and Len Lai, the filmmaker. And he said, I walked up to him at the screening once of his films. I had seen A Bike Boy and My Hustler. And he said, I said, may I come and interview you? And he said, all right, but I never say anything. And I said, that's all right. And we made an appointment and a time. I went to 47th Street. There was an elevator there. It had no top, I remember. So you went up in the shaft. I don't remember the floor exactly.
Four.
The fourth floor, the door opened. At that moment, my life changed. How many of us can say, at this very moment, my life has changed forever? This door had a secret. Behind it was a completely new world. Behind it was someone I was waiting for. I was looking for the Zen master. I was looking for a spiritual guide. And this man walked up to me. He was very pale. He was wearing what I was told years later was a wig. It was a kind of white, gray, floppy blonde wig. He had prescription glasses, very dark, so you could never see his eyes. He was wearing a very thin polo shirt with, it was gray with blue stripes, white wide whale corduroy pants, which were considered fashionable then, with a silver cardboard belt, and I think black shoes or boots. He was not wearing his jacket, which was velvet or velveteen, but piped to look like denim, which was considered very fashionable also. And he came up to me and said, hi, I'm Andy Warhol. And I said, how do you do? I'm Gretchen. Something happened at that moment. I knew that this was someone like myself. This person had suffered. This person had been ridiculed. This person had been kicked around. This person had been made to feel bad about himself. I found years later he had been sick as a child. He had all kinds of things that were wrong with him. He was not like the other children, shall we say. He was very, very different. And he'd been made to feel bad about that. And I found someone who was like myself, because I also was a very unhappy person at that time. And I spoke to him for a while. He asked me to sit down. And he said, call me Andy. And I had this very odd mystical experience, which I would like to detail to you. As though he had become a Zen priest. And we were both in robes near priests who were chanting and turning prayer wheels. And these prayer wheels were saying, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, the jewel in the heart of the lotus, the jewel in the heart of the lotus, the jewel in the heart of the lotus. His work is very, very religious. It's based on chanting. And if you chant long enough, you will become Sartori, which is the highest form of Zen. And he was very much like that. And I had this experience. Then I crashed into the everyday. The rock on the music came in, and Mick Jagger was bawling about Satisfaction. And the Beach Boys were saying, let us live together in the world where we belong. And the Ronettes were singing Along Comes Mary and all those wonderful rock songs. And this man was standing in front of me. I proffered my hand in the Western manner to shake his hand. A very limp paw was put into my hand. I moved it up and down. It did not grasp mine, it nestled inside. I said, good afternoon, Mr. Warhol. And I let the hand go, and he said, call me Andy. And at that moment, I knew that I had found a friend, in a manner of speaking, because I was never that close to him. I spoke to him for a long time. I hung around the factory. He was very kind, very nice. He even liked my work. I showed him my portfolio. He made some comments on it. He said I should go to his gallery. I should use his name. I never took advantage of this, but it was a very nice thing to say. And I went home with the material, and I decided that there wasn't quite enough of him speaking because he was very reticent. He didn't speak in long bursts, so I decided to edit it a little. That is what you have in the interview, and Chris was very kind. He said that I had created Andy Warhol that we know today.
That said, Chris, why don't we have a segment now? The sound on this is not going to be terrific, so use your imagination and don't whisper among yourselves.
This was taped in 1966 when Gretchen was 23, and this has never been heard in a public audience, to the best of my knowledge, before. As Andy said, this was his first recorded interview, but I think he was lying.
What did you mean in Esquire you would like Sedgwick to play because she does everything better than you do?
Well, they just asked who would you want to play a part, so I mean, it was just a...
Just a surface question?
Yes,
a surface answer. I just wondered if you have some kind of an image that you like to present to people in photographs to prevent them from knowing the real anymore?
I don't have time to think about
Could you just tell the audience, repeat just the part about television and movies and the part about Edie versus Baby Jane? Because admittedly, it's hard to get.
What Andy was saying was that he was talking about, Gretchen had asked him whether Andy was, the difference between Edie and Baby Jane, and he said one of them had longer hair, Baby Jane did. But he was saying that they didn't really have any, they weren't modeled on him. Edie did what she wanted to do, like most women would do. And then at the end of the interview, he talked about how television was going to take over from movies and how TV was so important. And I think among many things that Warhol said and that have been credited to him, that a lot of the things in this interview that Gretchen did with him are many of the things that Warhol's quoted for, that you'll see, you know, endlessly, whether it's on Twitter feeds or, you know, at people's Facebook pages or whatever. They're quotes from Andy Warhol, and a lot of them came from Gretchen's remarkable interview with Andy when she was just in her early 20s.
Gretchen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, Taylor, you had an experience, unlike Gerard, who was with Andy constantly through those years. Taylor left the country in the end of 64 and came back in late 67. So in a sense, you saw Andy before he was famous, and by the time you came back, he was pretty big. And anything you can say about the, if there was any difference between the before and after?
Well, he'd become, with Campbell Soup then, he was a huge sensation by 61, 60, 62. And, but he was Hollywood, New York promise. I did a play for which I won an Obie, a Frank O'Hara play. And along with that, I did a Leroy Jones play, which was, I played a white minister in a black church. It was integrated. But a month or two before, The Dutchman came out, and Leroy was selling black against white. And I think Martin King said, we aren't doing that anymore. But anyway, he, Frank O'Hara, and you know, if you win an Obie, if you have a major off-Broadway show with Al Pacino and Dustin Hoffman and so many more, if the play runs, the Hollywood people come down eventually. We had four performances, and the director double-sold the seats. Disaster. But we were offered any theater downtown, and Roy Jones kept telling Frank O'Hara, I'll sign tomorrow. He had no intention. He was selling black against white with The Dutchman. He's also phony. And it's such Hollywood, New York bullshit, you know. And and I told Frank O'Hara, but he would become a curator of art at the Museum of MoMA. And I said, Frank, Roy keeps promises. And Frank was associated with the rich uptown people. They said, oh, Taylor, what can I do? You know, so fucking elegant. And I knew what I could do. So rather than shoot Leroy or Andy, who was making promises like crazy, he'd tell you anything. I went to Europe for 3 years. And Andy, after I went to Chelsea Girls at the Cinematheque in Paris, and I was with Jean-Jacques Lebel, who was sort of head of the underground in Paris until he inherited $400 million. They walked out. My French friends walked out. And I said, what the hell am I doing in La Dolce Vita land? They don't know that's for real. It's New York. No two takes. But they couldn't believe it. And then Andy said, oh, Taylor, we've got so many parts for you, you know, Hollywood talk. But you got to come back. And that sort of made me start thinking. And then the next day I ran into Mickey Ruskin, who ran the cauldron of the young artists in Max's Kansas City, at 17th and Park Avenue South, now a deli. And he said, Taylor, I've got this great place you'd fit right in. That did it. And I came back, and the day I got off the plane, Andy had me doing Imitation of Christ out on the docks and everything. And Max's Kansas City, I lived there for weeks, months, years, owed them thousands. I now owe $250,000 to the McNally brothers and of Cipriani's, and, well, you know, I got to live. And I'm spoiled.
Gerard, I'm going to jump to you because the factory wouldn't be the factory without all the people that came in, and it wasn't primarily an art. It was an art-making place, but the crowd that came in was much broader than that, and you were one of the people responsible for that, both bringing in the fashion world and the poetry world.
Well, it appeared that I knew a lot of people, and I thought that it would be an interesting mix to invite people that I knew that Andy didn't know to the factory just for amusement's sake, that they would see something new and different in a creative way going on in what we were doing with the silk screening of the paintings, and then we would have screenings of films that would come back from the lab, you know, every other day, so we would have a lot of people coming to see underground movies at the factory, films that eventually would later be released at the Filmmaker Cinematheque. So it was, and I got a lot of enjoyment out of bringing people to the factory and for them to have a good time, so it just seemed a kind of entertaining thing to do at the time.
Okay, this is kind of throwing open to everybody. We may not learn a lot about the sex life of Andy Warhol, but at least we can know something about the drug scene.
It was a big gray cock he had.
Great.
He tried to make it with me, but not my type.
So, in terms of
the sex life of Andy Warhol.
There it is.
I can tell you three.
Okay.
Jimmy Williams, Edward Wallowitz, and Jed Johnson.
And there was Philip Phelan.
Fagan.
Rod LaRod, whose real name was Rod Thomas. Gerard, did you have any sense of the boyfriends, of what the relationship was?
You know, I knew some of these people, but I never, unless I was being naive or something, I never really thought of them as Andy's boyfriends. They just seemed to sort of latch on to Andy in a kind of masochistic or sadistic way, especially Rod LaRod. I mean, you couldn't take him anywhere to a restaurant, and then within 10 minutes he'd be attacking Andy at the dinner table. It was always very embarrassing with him.
Wasn't there a young man named Jed Johnson?
Well, Jed was much later.
Yeah.
And that seemed to sort of settle Andy down, and that was a more sincere and serious relationship. But the early ones, I couldn't make head or tail of what was going on. It was too crazy.
Okay, enough sex. Back to drugs. I mean, I think we may not think of how important the amphetamine scene was at that time. I was Lillian, we're here tonight, because she was the high priestess in the mid-60s, along with Ondine, of amphetamine.
Well, that was a subculture.
That was, yeah.
The amphetamine scene was a kind of ancillary or a subculture to the underground culture that Andy seemed to surround himself with. And I indulged in that for a while. I used to hang out. In fact, I even gave it a name, the Dawn Patrol, only because we'd be up all night and stumble into the street, and then we would go directly to the diner that was on the corner of Lafayette and Bond Street, sadly gone a couple of years ago. And I always found it kind of fascinating because I'd go up and it would be a group of us. We'd meet at somebody's apartment like at 9 or 10 in the evening, and everybody was playing records, and everybody would then go into little groups. Whatever was going on, it was a very kind of intellectual atmosphere to a certain extent. I'd go off in a corner and write some poetry. I always wondered what these people did, though. They seemed talented at something, but I couldn't put my finger on it. It was quite, because I always thought of a junkie or a drug addict as something very demi-monde or whatever, but this had a different flair to it. It was very unusual. And But everybody was very friendly and even encouraging to my own work, and it was a very friendly atmosphere, and it was always something that took place after hours from the factory, and a number of the people in the group were also people who were in a lot of Andy's films. So there was a crossover between this amphetamine subculture and the Andy Warhol art and film scene.
I mean, do you think part of that is people on amphetamine talk amazingly, and Andy wanted to receive that?
Well, I used to call that amphetamine rapture. That was another term I came up with.
Okay.
And yes, that's very true. People who are on amphetamine would get into a rap, you know, and be talking constantly. And that's something that Andy was attracted to for his sound movies, where he had a lot of these characters in the films.
Gretchen, you wanted to say something.
Paul Morrissey, who is not here tonight, but his spirit hangs over us. Paul Morrissey told me that Andy Warhol took a drug to control his weight called Obitrol, which does contain, I believe, some amphetamine. And he was very firm about that. I believe Paul was someone who never touched drugs himself, or maybe even alcohol. And he said Andy Warhol never took anything other than Obitrol.
Yeah, I've been to the drugstore with Andy where we picked up his Obitrol.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
In those days, it was over the counter. It was not a prescription drug.
Yep.
And he did take it. Andy at the time when I first started working with him was maybe slightly on the pudgy side, and also a little self-conscious about his weight, and he was taking Obitrol for that specific reason, was to reduce his appetite and thus hopefully reduce his weight.
Now, John, you were really much more of a marijuana guy.
Marijuana, everybody in the underground press smoked dope. I mean, everywhere I went in the world, every paper, every underground paper, anywhere, every underground paper throughout the world, and I was in 20 countries maybe, there were always underground papers. Two things they wanted. They wanted to end the Vietnam War and legalize marijuana. And they smoked marijuana all the time, and I smoked marijuana all the time, every day. And most of the time up at the factory, I was the only person smoking, therefore the only person holding, therefore the only person to hit on to get a drag. And I just dimly remember one day passing the joint around and Andy taking a drag. But such was the circumstances that I'm not sure. I don't know whether he ever did or not.
I have it on film.
Sorry?
I have it on film.
I have a wonderful story about Gerard, which I have probably mythologized by now, but it always struck me as being about as Warholian a scene as you could get. And we all got in the limousine one night and went up to this midnight screening at a movie theater on 57th Street with a fairly long opening lobby outside. And we started to get out of the limousine, and Gerard was first. And he started to walk towards the cinema theater, and the manager walked towards him, thought Gerard was Andy, and nobody corrected him the entire night. Gerard signed autographs. Andy, being Andy, just smiled.
That's perfect.
There are occasions that sort of, I mean, if people ask you to try and explain him, which, you know, all 20 people in my book are not able to do in whatever it is, 30, 40,000 words, it's very hard to explain him. But there are certain incidents, and another one was, we were all in Max's Kansas City one night, which was that bar that we just spent all our time in, especially mm-hmm. when the factory was moved to Union Square. And that was really a home of drama queens, you know, and Bridget used to shout and scream and leap on tables. And but anyway, so we're there one night, and this young, nondescript guy comes in, and he's from Philadelphia, and he's just started a newspaper in Philadelphia, a little tabloid newspaper. And he asked Andy, and the chutzpah, he asked Andy if Andy would write a column for it.
Yeah.
And much to everybody's amazement, Andy agreed. And what they did was, this, I think Paul Morrissey was mostly behind this, because what they did was they used to buy the National Enquirer every week, take out the most scandalous column, remove all the bold-faced names and substitute superstars, and hand the column back in. You know, there were all kinds of occasions like that. And one night I was, when they first took over the Dom, that Polish place on St. Mark's Place, they really loved it. They just signed Lou and the Velvets to play. And Gerard, when they had, this was the beginning of discotheque. This was before discotheque. Gerard would be wearing leather pants and flashing foot-long flashlights and dancing, and all the movies would be on the walls at the same time, and spotlights were going, and it was crazy. And I'm walking with, on this minstrel's gallery at the back, I'm walking with Andy, sort of overlooking it all, and we come to this guy who's working the spotlight. And as we approach him, he says to Andy, could somebody take this over for a while, Andy? I've got to make a phone call, go to the John, whatever. Andy literally grabbed the nearest person, said, will you please take this over? And the guy could have held it very gingerly and experimented with the spotlight. Then he discovered the colored gels, and then he discovered what you could do with it. Like it, within minutes, he was like, he was like an expert, within minutes, like, we're going to... And Ronnie Tavell's comment about something else, but which perfectly fits that, is that creativity can be forced.
Ron Tavell really had a lot of the great observations about Andy.
Yeah, he was a fabulous catalyst. I mean, if you were around Andy, you worked. Mm-hmm. You did something, you know, but you worked.
Gretchen.
Yes. I would like to say that Andy Warhol had a milieu around him, an entourage, and with the exception of Alfred Stieglitz, the photographer, and the gallery owner, no American artist has had such an effect, such a strong effect on the lives, the personal lives, as well as the careers of those around him. Between Stieglitz and Warhol, there is no one who had that a strong effect. Young people went there after work, they went there after school, or they cut school and they hung out at the factory. It was a place of nourishment. It was a place of comfort. Come, they don't appreciate you, they ridicule you, but come here. I will comfort you. I will help you. I am the father. I am the spiritual guide. I am the old Zen master. And he drew people to him who cried out for this kind of comfort. And I felt this myself. I thought, you are the unmet friend. There is a possibility here, something not explored. You are the unmet friend that I'm looking for. And this was a very, very strong pull, and he accomplished this. And I think it was unique in American art. And
on that theme, Joseph, could you hand your thing and come up stage, on stage?
I'm sorry, I just have one thing to add to what Gretchen said, which was when I was interviewing David Bordone, who was an art critic, he was an art critic for Life once upon a time, he's now dead, but we'd established that among the influences behind Andy were Marcel Duchamp and Picasso and Salvador Dali. And I said to David, I said, well, who do you think that Andy's influence? He said, everybody. And that was like 1969, 1970, something like that.
You can, I assume that if I just do this.
Or I can.
You can do that. Oh, great. Okay. You've got 5 minutes. But I think it's an interesting story. Little Joey, as he was known at the time, worked with Andy in the factory, and Andy was very open to it. Tell the story about the Fagin or Peter Pan, and tell just about his calling your mother also.
Yeah, this is, my heart's beating. I don't normally speak in front of people, but it's okay.
These are fascinating people.
Can you hear me now? I'll do this. All right. I went to work for Andy when I was 13 years old. And I saw him on the cover of Tape Recording Magazine. And I was interested in gadgets the way people are into computers today. And I was just talking to Steve today about a lot of people who think of Andy as either a Fagin or a Peter Pan type of character. I always thought of him as Peter Pan, and I think Gretchen said some interesting things. He was very, very open to me and very, very kind. I don't think he really differentiated that much between young and old, as much as maybe other people. I had numerous conversations with him in great depth, and the minute the tape recorder was on, it would be monosyllabic. So, I mean, he would only say, you know, one-word answers. But once the tape recorder was off, you could talk to him about anything. He was very well-read. He saw all the latest movies. He was very, very interested in what was going on in the culture. And I always try to tape record him, you know, secretly. And for some reason, none of those tapes survive. It's almost like magic. But I used to call him up every Sunday from my house in Brooklyn. And I had a friend, and he would come over to the house, and I said, you can't believe this. This is, I will call up Andy Warhol, and he'll sit and talk with me for an hour. And Andy would do that. He would talk with me for an hour on the phone, and I tried to tape record him, and I did tape record him. And, you know, we're talking about the sex life of Andy Warhol. Obviously, I didn't have any sex with him, but I was a very, very young man. I used to go to his house every day after school and wake him up because he could never get to the factory on time. And he would be upstairs shaving and eating Cheerios, and he would come down every once in a while. I would sit in the, you know, in the parlor floor of a brownstone that he had on 89th Street, and he would come down and he would be wearing like cum-stained jockey shorts that he would just walk downstairs and say, Joe, you okay? You need anything? And then he would walk back up and he would disappear, and I never went up to the top floor of his house. In the 3 years that I was there, I never went up to the top floor until last year Gretchen and I went to his house, which was on sale, and the real estate agent showed it to us, and I went upstairs and I finally saw his bedroom and his kitchen. And anyway, you know, I listened to what you say. He was very, very, very nice to me on many, many levels. And I couldn't even begin to tell you all the stories, but I hope I've...
That's perfect.
Yeah, that's good enough.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Now, we are running out of time. We promised we'd do a few Q&As, so I think we've got 10 minutes. What I would say is, raise your hand, I'll point at you, direct the question to whom you want it to be answered, and speak loudly. Ah. Yes.
John, I know that I have been reading your autobiography, or at least of the Manhattan Memories.
Thank you for mentioning that.
Yes, it's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful book, and I just read the Marilyn Monroe, where you interviewed Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned her fragility, and the way you spoke with her, it occurred to me that perhaps, I actually assigned Andy Warhol, when I was at the New York Times op-ed page as art director, to do the portrait of Ted Kennedy, and to do it kind of blurry. I'm going sidetracked, but I'll get back. He came up with three portraits. I asked him to do a kind of a blurry, shadowy thing of Ted Kennedy, because nobody really knew him. In 1979, when he was running for president, and they knew he was a Kennedy, but what did he stand for? You know, so I said, well, make it kind of shadowy, blurry. So he said, well, send me some scrap. So of course, scrap is, you know, photographs. So I sent him three photographs, and when I got back, it was three gorgeous, huge portraits on huge pieces of really fine artist's paper,
yeah.
But they were just contour drawings. And my editor wouldn't let me run them. I said, I just tried everything. I said, let's just run the signature, you know? But because they didn't say enough, which was interesting, because usually the problem I had was, I just also wrote a book called All the Art That's Fit to Print, and some that wasn't, inside the New York Times op-ed page. And it has a lot of killed work. I include those three portraits of Ted Kennedy that were killed and they were never seen. And for the opposite reason, usually there was too much sex, or there were, you know, there were phalli or something, you know, breasts or something that editors would see. But this one is the opposite. Okay, now John, I want to ask you what you noticed. Yeah, exactly. Any. You've noticed any common thing between Marilyn and Andy?
So the question was, did he see any common thing between Marilyn and Andy?
Well, I thought it was interesting that Marilyn Monroe was one of the first things he did, wasn't it? That portrait of Marilyn Monroe. And I felt very lucky to have known not only Andy, but also to have known Marilyn Monroe, because I've never met anybody else who did, although obviously a lot of people did. But not to get too far from the subject, it happens to be the person that is most asked about. When people knew that I met Marilyn Monroe, that is the person everybody wants to know about. And she was incredibly simple and charming, and not at all like a star, and very real, and very almost innocent, but obviously smart, you know. And so I was happy to, you know, I was happy that they coincided in that he actually did that, that he actually did that portrait of her. But I was going to say there was something else I was going to point out. You know, Quentin Crisp, who's now dead, had very good advice, and that is that when you go on television, whatever they ask you, say what it is you wanted to talk about.
Yeah. Exactly.
Stephen reminded me that when I had my accident in Greece and was half killed in this road accident, my friends gave a benefit. And they went to Andy, and Andy did, this is a copy of it, Andy did a cover, he drew a cover of me from memory. But the interesting part is that my friends gave him a copy of my book on Venezuela, and the portrait on the back, the picture on the back, as you can see, would you hold that for me? Closely resembles the actual drawing. It's quite obvious when you look at it where he gets the model from, you know?
Yeah. Okay, the woman in back. No, you, not all the way back, two-thirds of the way back. You. You. Oh, it's, I'm sorry.
What?
Joan.
Yes.
Would you tell me something about her and maybe Gretchen and the gentleman sitting next to her, the actors? Why did she burn out? Like, I've seen the movie and I read about her, but it seemed like she burned out. What did she bring to the factory? And what made her, like, burn out like that?
You know, a lot of people, I've heard a lot of people fault Warhol and the factory for Edie's burnout and problems. But I'd like to say myself, just from my time of knowing her, that she was a Sedgwick all her life. She was only at the factory for about 1 year. And from everything that I know and everything I've seen and read, it was just about the happiest and most fulfilled time of her life. Granted, there was an upset, a disagreement, and they ended up very much at odds with one another, as friends do, and people running between them, I'm sure, making it a lot worse on both sides. But my take on it was that she came from an incredibly troubled background, an incredibly troubled family. She had an enormous drug problem. I mean, we all did drugs, but some people have a special destiny in that regard. My mother was one, and Edie certainly was one. And that has a lot more to do with her crash and burn than anything I think that happened at the factory. Just my opinion.
Do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I'll just make one comment. I never met Edie Sedgwick, but from all that I've heard, since she was sexually molested as a child, as a child and an adolescent by her father, there should be more research into this, because people who have had, women who have had this experience carry it all their life. I believe that this was the source of the drug problem.
Very destructive.
And there was no way that she had of taking that sorrow away from her.
Instead of doing more questions, because we're really close to the end, I would like each of the panelists to have 1 to 2 minutes to say anything they want. Do you feel okay about starting, Gerard?
No.
Okay. Okay, well then let's start with Taylor.
He was, I come from him. My father was Boston, Michigan, and I once answered the phone. It was Roosevelt calling my father. And I'm sort of jaded in regard to famous people. And like my father, that's why my book is Son of Andy Warhol. It has to do with my father. Terrible liar. My father's a liar. He was disbarred. And there's a great comparison there. And I grew up with this bullshit. And a father who wasn't there either. But I miss Andy tremendously. To be out with him. And Paul Morrissey claims to have made the movies. But Andy could be in another room. It was still Andy's movie. He had a tremendous, low-key, fantastic, phantasmagorical presence.
Perfect. Gretchen.
I would like to repeat the comment I made about Alfred Stieglitz and Andy Warhol, that they both had a tremendous effect upon the lives and the careers of those people around them. Most of the American artists we know did their art, showed up, had their careers and lives, but they did not affect anyone in particular. Alfred Stieglitz even was the mentor of a great American artist and married her, Georgia O'Keeffe. So I would like to leave you with that thought of the effect that both of these people had on everyone around them.
Great. Gerard, you ready?
Oh, am I ready? Yeah. Well, I just say a few words. Andy, I always considered Andy to be the second major turning point in my life as a young man, with an incredible legacy that I inherited. And he obviously will always remain a part of my history, and likewise vice versa. And that's something that I'll carry with me for the rest of my life.
Bibi.
I think for me, I take a lot from that short period of time with me, but one of the most profound things was Andy's attitude towards life and towards art, the art process that he had, his work ethic. They called it the factory. It wasn't called the party. work went on there. I love, one of the things that I always remember and always cherish about Andy was his endless curiosity and fascination. It was a mindfulness where just utterly enchanted and enthusiastic and interested and curious and fascinated about just about anything. And that is incredibly energizing when you get into that sort of being interested in. He wasn't a person who was sitting around being interesting. He was engaged. And I find that has influenced my life a great deal.
Great. So, John, you are our honoree in some ways tonight. So the last word shall be yours.
Well, I don't have very much to add. I have one little story, which I'll tell you in a moment. He was a very kind person. I mean, in all the years I knew him, which was, I suppose, 6 or 7, maybe even more, I never saw him angry. I never saw him nasty to anybody or mean. I mean, it's true that if you asked him a question, he would usually say, well, what do you think? Rather than give you an answer. And I don't want to do a crass promotion, but I do actually have a book called My Natural Memories. And the only reason I mention it is because there are 2 chapters on Andy in there. There's also marijuana and the early days of the Village Voice and the Soho art scene and everything else, you know. But the story I wanted to tell is very brief. Now I've forgotten it. I used to spend a lot of time at the factory, and one day I was there the whole day watching all the action and everything, and I went home, and on the way home I bought the New York Post, and in Leonard Lyon's column was this great story about what Andy was doing now, and I went home and I called Paul Morrissey and I said, I was there all day, Paul, and nobody even mentioned this. He says, Leonard Lyon's calls us every Wednesday and asks us what's happening, and I make something up for him.
That's good. Thank you, panelists. Okay. Chris Trella, who has turned that decidedly low-tech book by John Wilcock into the most looks book you can imagine, he's going to tell you about the signing.
After this, there's a stand out front, and the panel is going to be signing books out front. So I have my old copy of John's book. It wasn't put together too well, but I can assure you the copy outside that you're going to buy tonight will not fall apart. So hopefully you can get the book signed by everyone, and thank you for coming. I really appreciate it.
Yay.